let me see if I can get this right. It's company policy never to imply ownership in the event of a dildo. It's always a dildo, never your dildo.
Yes, that is a great.
That's my favorite line.
It's usually like a electric razor 9 times out of 10, but sometimes. And you think he's going to say like a bomb or something? He's like, right. It's a dildo or it's a vibrator.
He looks around to make sure no one's listening.
It's a vibrator.
Hello and welcome to My Favorite Movie Is, a podcast all about why we love our favorite movies. My name is Larry Fried and I'm the creator and host of this show. If this is your first time listening, again, welcome to MFMI. If you're coming back after listening to a previous episode, thank you so much. I really do appreciate your time and your energy and your listenership. Today's episode is a real doozy. We are talking to Brian Bittner, one of the co-writers on the Lessons from the Screenplay and Story Mode YouTube channels, as well as one of the co-hosts of one of my favorite film podcasts, Beyond the Screenplay, all about his favorite movie, the 1999 cultural landmark that is David Fincher's Fight Club.
It's like whenever someone's like, I don't agree with this character. It's like, well, you're not supposed to agree with them. They are there to challenge you. They're there to challenge the protagonist. And at the end of the movie, they are brought down. I think that that is what makes these movies challenging and interesting and fun, is that the antagonists are making good points, even if they're not the character to be sort of trusted and that you're supposed to be getting behind and rooting for.
Guys, this episode is filled to the brim with so many awesome conversations and topics. We talk about Fight Club and its place as the pinnacle of the unlikable protagonist genre of films. We also talk about how this film CGI is just incredibly dated and why that's exactly why it works. We also talk about the film's iconic twist and how it still holds up to this day, despite being maybe the most well-known film twist of all time outside of like Star Wars. This is easily one of my favorite episodes that we've recorded thus far, and I cannot wait to share it with you right now. Well, not like right now, because first I have to remind you that, you know, we go way past the red tape and deep into spoilers on every episode of My Favorite Movie Is, including this one. And I know everybody has seen Fight Club, but if you haven't seen Fight Club, I mean, we talk about everything. The very ending of the film, the twist, of course, all of its many different facets. So go check out the film if you haven't already, then come back to us so you can enjoy this awesome episode. Oh, and also just one more piece of like spoilery housekeeping. We go super film literate in this episode and we talk about a number of different films like Nightcrawler and Collateral and Swingers and American Beauty and The Dark Knight and just like a ton of different movies. And I know that some of you may be sensitive to just going into a film as blind as possible. And, you know, we do talk about specific scenes. So for everyone's sake, I made a list of all of the films that we talk about in any sort of specific detail in the show notes below, just in case you want to be on your guard. But for those of you who have seen Fight Club, that's most of you, let's just get this episode started. Brian, let's do it.
My name is Brian Bittner, and my favorite movie is Fight Club.
Brian Bittner, welcome to My Favorite Movie Is. How are you doing?
Good. I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I am doing great. Thanks for being here. For those who don't know who you are, which hopefully should be few, tell me a little bit about who you are, what you do, where people might know your work from.
Sure. So I write for the YouTube channel Lessons from the Screenplay, which is run by Michael Tucker, and he's the brainchild behind all of it. He brought on a small team, including myself and Trisha Arand and Alex Calleros and our producer, Vince Major. We have since launched a podcast called Beyond the Screenplay, where each week we sort of, Lessons from the Screenplay is a very surgical, you know, look at a movie where we spend hours and hours and hours making a 9 to 12 minute video that like really focuses on one lesson. Beyond the Screenplay allows us to let our hair down a little bit, talk about how we feel about the movie and explore some lessons more in depth and all that kind of thing. And then we have also started a YouTube channel called Story Mode, which is looking at storytelling in video games. We sort of break down what makes storytelling in video games such a special thing.
All of that content is fantastic, never disappoints. So of course, everybody should go check that out after you're done listening to this first. Very exciting today because we're talking about a film that is one of the cultural cornerstone films, and that is, of course, Fight Club, directed by David Fincher. It's really interesting, you know, obviously on this show, we want to cover a wide gamut of films, the most beloved to the hidden gems to everything in between. But Fight Club really is the movie, which is a weird way to put it because there's a wide variety of films. You don't want to, you know, just pick one to be, you know, the film that you feel like represents film culture in a way. But Fight Club, I find is very representative of sort of like film fandom, because so many people love it and so many people talk about it. And I'm curious, from your perspective, you saw it when it was first coming out. So I'm curious for you, first of all, I mean, we're going to start the show like we always do, which is tell me about how you discovered this film, what your reactions were when you first saw it, and how did you see it? And then what was it like experiencing it when it came out? Because, you know, obviously it's a cult classic. It did not have as much of a bang when it first came out. So I'm wondering what that was like for you.
I had a friend in around this time, 99. He was a freshman in college and I was a senior in high school. So he was in the college environment, right? So he was always down the dorm hall from people who had movies or wanted to go to the movies or whatever. And I was still, you know, in high school, and maybe I'd go to a movie once in a while, but I was still sort of discovering my love of film, I think. So he would come home for a weekend and he'd say, "Hey man, have you seen Being John Malkovich?" And I'd say no, and he'd be like, "Let's go." And it'd be like 10 o'clock at night and he'd just take me to the theater and we'd go see it. And then come home again, "Have you seen The Messenger, the new Luc Besson movie?" "No, let's go." And he'd take me and we'd go see it. And then one of these was Fight Club, which at this point was no longer in theaters for its like primary run, but in our hometown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, they had this theater that was like $2 to see a movie that was just out of theaters but still not on like home video yet. And it's this grimy theater in kind of the bad part of town, which is just what a perfect way to see Fight Club for the first time.
The perfect place to see Fight Club.
Yeah.
You would literally meet people from Fight Club going right. to see Fight Club.
Right. There were a lot of people with black eyes nodding at me as I left. but yeah, and I liked it a lot, and I forget at what point my film understanding was around at this point, because I loved Seven and I don't know if I had like a real understanding of like, oh, this is the person who made Seven. I think I did, but not like in the way it was like still IMDb wasn't quite there yet to go on and start like poking around and seeing what people had done and that kind of thing. But I liked it a lot. And I had already liked Edward Norton and Brad Pitt and plenty of things I had seen. Helena Bonham Carter is great. And but then I think it became, to answer your second question about sort of like what was like the tale of that, I think, was then I did go to college. The movie did come out on DVD. And then I was able to, you know, to start watching it and kind of, again, that freshman year of college experience of someone seen something that you haven't seen, you're going to watch it together. Or like, have you heard of this like weird, obscure thing? Or, have, you know, so I remember watching it on my own in my dorm room. My girlfriend walked in, she saw the last 20 minutes, spoiled the ending, but she's like, "I want to watch this movie now." So we watched it the next day. Then my roommate comes into the room, he sees the last 20 minutes, spoiled the ending. He's like, "I want to watch this movie now." So we watched it the next day. And it was just that environment of bringing your friends over and watching movies that you haven't seen and that kind of thing. So I think there were a lot of movies around that time, because 99 was such a jam-packed year of movies, and like 2000 and 98 and even 2001. So it was like you would find those Donnie Darko and the Boondock Saints and these movies where maybe they didn't make this huge splash when they came out, but then everyone you know is like talking about them and now you're all watching them together. And now, next thing you know, you've watched them 10 times with your friends over the course of a year or something. So yeah, I think Fight Club sort of started to permeate the young male culture at that point, which is a problem a little bit, and we can get into that. We definitely should get into that.
We shall.
Yeah, but it just sort of became the movie that like now everyone has seen and everyone is quoting and everyone is talking about, you know, almost ad nauseum, I think, for a lot of people, which is why some people are, you know, are critical of Fight Club, just because it's like that song in the radio that you don't want to hear again. It's like the song's not worse, it's just you're sick of hearing it.
Yeah, you know how many times has someone been like, "Have you seen Fight Club? Oh man, my favorite movie is Fight Club." You know, there are these sort of hyper masculine films that have really been co-opted by certain people. But back then, it was obviously a much newer sensation. I'm curious, like, if you can remember at all, like, was there something about Fight Club that you maybe like you hadn't seen before in movies, or was there something about it that was particularly compelling?
I definitely was forming this personality of, I like movies that are really going to explore an idea. You know, most movies should have a theme and explore a theme, but very few movies, or not very few movies, but a lot of them, the theme is just this very thin layer on top of it, or you have to kind of dig into it. And I like these movies that are sort of like, we're going to like really dig into something. So when I was a teenager, I was watching A Clockwork Orange and Natural Born Killers and Seven.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of David Lynch, right? And it's these are all movies, and even Kevin Smith, right? Like, these are all movies where you're going, hey, they're talking about something. They're actually having, yeah, like the characters are having a conversation about an idea, and I appreciate that. And then 99 was this amazing year of all of these movies that were you know, you can have movies that are fun, but don't really have a lot to say. You can have movies that have a lot to say, but they're very talky and maybe not a lot of stuff going on. And then 99, you had Fight Club, The Matrix, American Beauty, Being John Malkovich, The Iron Giant, Magnolia, Arlington Road, Office Space, Three Kings. These movies that were like fun and funny and entertaining to watch, but also were like grappling with an idea and really making you, you know, trying to challenge you to think about things a little bit and sort of step outside. Weirdly, half of them are about a bored office worker, corporate office worker who has to sort of get out of his life, you know.
Bizarre how that all comes together.
So I think that was a huge part of it. And you know, I think the problem with Fight Club is that people think Tyler should be taken seriously, which like we absolutely need to get into this a lot. But I think that what I like about all of these movies was they were saying like, hey, maybe life the way, you know, your parents told you it should be is not the best way to be happy. Maybe you should think about things. Maybe you should reconsider your choices and that kind of thing. And I think people maybe thought Fight Club went too far on the edge because it's like, no, he's not telling you go live in an abandoned house. It's just saying like, maybe you don't need that, you know, striped green couch to feel happy with your life. Maybe you can be happy on your own, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it was more less about this movie itself and more just about the fact that movies were doing this thing around that time that I just really gravitated towards, where I would watch a movie and then want to talk about it with my friends for hours afterwards and think about what implications it had and that kind of thing. And it doesn't mean you have to take any movie as religion, which again is what movies like Fight Club can do for people, but it does mean you can take a movie as philosophy that makes you consider things, that makes you think about things and while also being entertaining as hell at the same time. And I think that's what I appreciate about especially Fight Club. It's so irreverent and funny and weird like while also doing all those other things. And I think that maybe being brought up on A Clockwork Orange and Natural Born Killers, I keep using those, and even Rocky Horror Picture Show, honestly.
Oh, that's movies another, about, yeah, for sure.
Right, movies where the main character is like not, you're not supposed to like Lost Highway. I think all of these movies, with the exception maybe of Seven, the main characters are awful, horrible people. The movie is like literally showing you a fun scene of them murdering somebody or something, and I'm like, I personally don't watch that and think like, yeah, murder's fun. I watch that and go, no, the movie is entertaining me and telling me something and you know, talking about a theme. So I think for me, one of the reasons why I always get surprised when people criticize Fight Club saying like, oh, but Tyler says this and that's not true, or I don't agree with the thing Tyler says. I'm like, yeah, you're not supposed to agree with him. Like you're maybe supposed to be challenged by him and stuff. But again, it's like when I grew up watching movies with just terrible protagonists, I pretty quickly was able to separate myself from thinking that the movie is telling me the way that this person is acting is like a good way to act. You know, one thing I find interesting is a lot of movies, Reservoir Dogs or something, it's like, here's all these bad people doing bad things, and now at the end, they're all dead. So it's like, there's a pretty clear, you know, message there. But then there are movies like Clockwork Orange and Natural Born Killers. I won't spoil the ending for anyone who hasn't seen it, but the protagonists don't get the comeuppance you maybe would expect, which can be frustrating at first until you realize, oh, the movie's not about them. The movie is about the society surrounding them. So the movie is making commentary on the fact that they are sort of able to get away with it because of how media is treating them and how society is treating them, that kind of thing, you know? And I think Fight Club is doing that too, where it's sort of, put it this way, we get very used to movies where we like the protagonist in Hollywood and that kind of thing. It's like, look, what a good guy Hugh Grant is, and I like him a lot, and nothing he does is wrong. Therefore, that's what all movies are, you know? And then when you see a movie where the protagonist is questionable, then I think for most of us, we can look at it and go, oh, I get it. You're showing me a bad person. And what is that going to say about this movie? For some people, maybe they're like, wait a minute, I don't want to watch a movie about a person who is doing bad things. Like, that's not what movies should be. So I think it can be tricky for some people sometimes.
These are all movies about people who engage in terrible behavior, but they are the protagonist. The key is to make it compelling, is to make the characters compelling, to make the characters interesting, to make the characters' motivations really strong. You can find yourself in those motivations, but you're not, as you said, you know, don't replicate them, but simply view them as like a canvas for which you can see other things. And I think Tyler Durden and even the narrator, which, you know, we can talk about them as the same person, we can talk about them separately, they're both terrible. Both personifications of them are terrible in a number of ways. They both do terrible things, but the movie obviously condemns Tyler Durden, you know, obviously by the end. The narrator feels the need to shoot himself in order to get rid of Tyler Durden, and we acknowledge what Tyler Durden does is bad. But as you said, the narrator learns a lot of things about himself through the journey he takes with Tyler Durden, and ultimately he is better off, even though he is deeply scarred, both literally and metaphorically, he has learned a lot about himself and he has confronted a lot of issues about himself. That's why Fight Club works, and that's why it sucks that, you know, a lot of people can't really read those things.
Right.
But the great thing about this genre, this sort of the unlikable protagonist genre, is that there's different levels. You know, something like a Nightcrawler is very different from Fight Club, because Nightcrawler, it's very clear that Lou Bloom, who's the main character of Nightcrawler, is irreputable and not a good person and does bad things, but his motivations are compelling and are an extension of a good motivation, which is that he works hard and he feels the need that he has to work hard to get what he wants. It's just obviously to a level that is unacceptable. In Fight Club, you have sort of a different, it's a little bit different because the narrator and Tyler Durden sort of represent two different sides of a coin, which sort of makes them interesting films to compare and contrast in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was thinking about this a lot while preparing for this. And I think it's interesting when people think a movie character is supposed to be taken seriously and when they don't. So I think on one end of the spectrum, you have a character like Jack Torrance, the Joker, Hannibal Lecter, Anton Chigurh, even Lou Bloom from Nightcrawler, where it's like if people quote them and dress like them, no one really minds, because it's like, oh, yeah, you know that's the bad guy. You know that's the character who is like very clearly over the top, not to be taken seriously in the sense of like, we know these movies are not communicating. Like, isn't this person right about everything? Shouldn't you go kill your family? Shouldn't you eat people? Whatever, you know? I think The Social Network, Scott Pilgrim, High Fidelity, where the main characters are empathetic, but they're assholes, right? Like they're not doing good things, and you sort of realize they're not going to doing good things as you go, but they're still presented as like, but here is your protagonist. You are kind of cheering for them. You are kind of hoping they get what they want. You know, every once in a while I'll read like I was reading a feminist critique of High Fidelity recently, for instance.
And, another great movie to throw into this pantheon.
They were saying like, well, I don't like that Rob does this, and John Cusack is, you know, my sweet 80s boy, and I don't like that he's doing this and saying this. And I'm like, well, yeah, you're not supposed to. Like, and I think that's the thing that always rubs me the wrong way, is these movies are all about flawed protagonists who either learn their lesson at the end or who are brought down at the end. You know, I love that Social Network ends in such a shitty way for Mark. Like he sort of gets everything he wants and is still just miserable. And to me, like, yeah, that's the point of that movie.
Yes.
And then I think people say, yeah, but they're the protagonist and you're kind of rooting for them and you're having fun watching them. And I think they'll start saying like the movie is glorifying their behavior. But it's like, well, if you're going to show me an unlikable character, movies are entertainment. So like I want to be entertained. And I the same way that if Joker makes a pencil disappear, I can have fun watching that without thinking that's something I think someone should do. I should also be able to watch a protagonist do something, you know, be mean to somebody and think, okay, I don't like you, I don't agree with you, but also that was a fun scene and like maybe I had a good time watching it and that kind of thing. And I can separate those things because I understand the movie is not saying you should be like this. So then finally you have this interesting subgenre of movies that I love, where you have two diametrically opposed main characters who represent opposite takes on a theme and they spend a lot of time together. And the three that I've been thinking about the most are Fight Club, Collateral, and Swingers. You wouldn't think Swingers would be in that same thing, but
Swingers
hear me
is
out.
Definitely not in that other pantheon, but we'll go with right. it. But we'll go with it.
But speaking of Collateral, Michael Mann does this all the time.
Yes.
Public Enemies.
Collateral's a great example. Right. Yeah.
Heat, The Insider. He has a ton of movies about two characters with like opposing philosophies who are or butting heads.
That's just good screenwriting.
Right, the conflict is built into it. So these are movies where the protagonist is not really committing to life. He needs someone to bring him out of his shell. So then this other character steps in to do that. But the other character isn't necessarily a good person, and they're often the antagonist, or they're sort of revealed to be the antagonist over the course of the movie. So again, the movie is not saying you should be like the antagonist, but they are saying if there's a sliding scale from protagonist to antagonist, the protagonist needs to sort of move along that scale maybe in that. And of course, it's not a two-dimensional sliding scale, but they need to kind
right,
of
yes.
be brought out. They cannot, maybe need to listen to that a little bit. The main thing to remember is all three of these movies end with the antagonist being defeated at the end. The protagonist may be in a better place for having met them, but that doesn't mean they also learn the antagonist is not right about life. You know, they maybe help pull me into this like place of balance, but both people are right and both people are wrong. Like Collateral is a good example. Like the protagonist is right about, you know, how to be a human being, but he's wrong about not living his own life and stuff. Vincent is right about maybe his philosophy on doing things and actually getting things done. He's not right about murder and things like that. So again, it's it's like whenever someone's like, I don't agree with this character, it's like, well, you're not supposed to agree with them. They are there to challenge you. They're there to challenge the protagonist. And at the end of the movie, they are brought down and therefore are, you know, hopefully you should realize that as the movie saying, hey, Tyler Durden's philosophy ended, turned into Project Mayhem. Tyler Durden's philosophy turned into the protagonist literally having to shoot himself in the face just to get rid of this side of him, you know? And don't get me wrong, I love Tyler's lines. I was totally quoting them and saying, you know, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need.
Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes. Working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need.
Because I also think he makes a good point. I think Vincent in Collateral makes a good point. I think that that is what makes these movies challenging and interesting and fun, is that the antagonists are making good points, even if they're not the character to be sort of trusted and that you're supposed to be getting behind and rooting for. End of rant.
That was a great illustration, first of all, of everything. I think you encapsulate the point really well. The fascinating thing about Fight Club, which I think makes it the quintessential version of this, is, you know, not only does it ultimately condemn the horrible protagonist, which I think, you know, is very important in films like this. And there are films that I've seen that do end up glorifying, you know, horrible protagonists, which is when you sort of, you know, I think when movies at times can fail or maybe become too indulgent in this trope. Fight Club ultimately condemns the protagonist, but it also, that's why the twist really adds a whole other layer of brilliance to it, because the narrator is Tyler Durden. So the antagonist is literally a representation of a character's own problems.
You were looking for a way to change your life. You could not do this on your own. All the ways you wish you could be, that's me. I look like you want to look. I am smart, capable, and most importantly, I'm free in all the ways that you are not.
This character's emotional problem, the character's flaws, are fully personified by the unlikable protagonist character. It's a perfect way of doing this unlikable protagonist trope successfully.
And then Fight Club is interesting because, as you pointed out, the narrator is not like a great guy, but he's sort of a normal guy. You know, he's like obviously co-opting the support groups and stuff like that at the end. So, you know, he's doing stuff that we don't really agree with, but he's sort of just a bland vanilla person until he meets Tyler. But then what's smart here is, as the narrator gets sucked into Tyler's philosophy, now we have the very important character of Marla. First of all, she's seeing things through Marla's eyes, which is she's seeing this one person act like two people, and that's crazy, right? But even forgetting about the twist, Marla becomes our sort of audience character. The more unlikable the narrator gets, the more we are watching the movie through Marla's eyes and going, you know, or even Bob, Meatloaf's character, to a lesser extent, you know, because he is the sort of, like, he is the character who we're like, aw, like, I care about you, kind of the Riz Ahmed character in Nightcrawler, the character where you're like, I just want to give you a hug and take you away from these horrible people. But then also, I think that what is smart in the Project Mayhem act of this movie is that the Space Monkeys are so ridiculous in their sort of cultishness and all that kind of stuff that it becomes so clear that the movie is saying this is not good behavior, right? So then now the narrator starts to become our likable protagonist again, because we're seeing him go, hang on, this isn't what I wanted. I wanted to go punch each other and cry. Like, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to start like burning down buildings and that kind of thing. And I think it's a great moment where, as the narrator sort of gone far and farther away from we are becoming misaligned with the narrator in the second act of this movie. The third act gets us back on track with him, where he's like, this shit has gone too far. I need to help get back on track. And we're like, okay, now I'm rooting for you again, because you've seen the light of day and you've seen that this philosophy is not a way to live your life, which is why people shouldn't quote Tyler Durden as if everything he says is gospel, because the movie is showing you that that's insane.
Yes. I think the character of Marla, I think, is very easy to dismiss when you first watch the film, because she is so much on the sidelines for a good portion of the film. But as you mentioned, bringing her in towards the end, when the narrator is forced to recognize his own follies and his emotional problems, which is heavily understated in this movie, but looking on it with a modern lens now, is such an important part of this film. That scene with them in the diner is such an important scene. And it's that scene, you know, I think is really the heart of the film. And that moment on the bus is so great. Like, them acknowledging this unspoken, messy relationship that they have with each other is really just a beautiful moment, and helps us remember the emotional heart of this film before we get into the incredibly chaotic third act.
The full extent of our relationship wasn't really clear to me up until now, for reasons I'm not going to go into. But the important thing is, I know that I haven't been treating you so nice.
Nice.
Yeah, whatever.
No. 15 seconds. 15 seconds, please. Please, 15 seconds. Don't open your mouth or move. I'm trying to tell you that I'm sorry. Because what I've come to realize is that I really like you, Marla.
You do?
I really do.
And it's just like, it's so annoying when these films so beautifully illustrate these ideas. I think Fight Club is one of the best ones to illustrate this idea. But I feel like when a film is also entertaining, and I mean, Fight Club's a really badass movie. I mean, it has a lot of great scenes and has a lot of really compelling, fun moments. I mean, the projection scene is, you know, a classic, right. A classic scene. But when you have those entertaining, funny moments, aesthetics tend to get conflated with characters and ideas. My film appreciation teacher in high school would always say, you watch a film first as a consumer and then second as an artist. And I think that really holds true.
And I would argue, and third as a philosopher.
And third as a philosopher. There you go.
Do you know what I mean?
I will send that to my teacher and we'll add that to the chart.
Right.
Because especially with a movie like Fight Club or The Matrix, you have those all these aesthetics that are meant to wow you and to compel you. And then, I mean, especially with Fight Club, with the twist that is so iconic, as in Fight Club, it's going to require two or three viewings. So that way you can see how everything is laced together. And I mean, gosh, a second viewing of Fight Club is like, it's a whole other movie.
I think what's cool about Fight Club is it works without the twist.
I would even go so far as to say that if the person knew the twist going in, they would still be fascinated by the film, because the film,
twist
elucidates so much more about the film. In fact, I saw the film recently with somebody who could tell. They had an idea of what the twist was very early on in those initial scenes where Marla and the narrator are talking to each other in the kitchen.
You won't believe this dream I had last night.
Yeah, I can hardly believe anything about last night.
What are you doing here?
What?
This is my house. What are you doing in my house?
He had a sense of what the twist was going to be, but he still really enjoyed the movie because the twist is like layered into this film so deeply. It's like it's a foundational part of the movie, so much so that it doesn't ruin the movie by knowing it. It just makes it even better. It makes it even more interesting to watch. Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying this week's episode of My Favorite Movie Is. I hate to interrupt this awesome conversation, but I just wanted to remind you all that you can find more episodes of My Favorite Movie Is by going to our show page on your podcasting platform of choice. And if you like video podcasts, we actually post our video versions for every podcast episode on YouTube. New audio episodes drop every other Monday, and then video episodes drop that following Friday. So I hope you'll subscribe and follow us and hit that notification bell and do all the things you got to do to stay updated on when new episodes go live. Another way to stay updated on when new episodes go live and get some fun bonus content and sneak peeks in between episodes is to follow us on our social media pages at MFMI Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. I hope you guys will find us there and stay updated and check out all the cool stuff we're doing on those platforms. And finally, for a full catalog of audio and video episodes, as well as more information about the show and how you can contact us for any reason, you can go to MFMIPodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening to My Favorite Movie Is. Let's get back to the show. I want to move on to another topic. I want to talk a little bit about David Fincher. Fight Club is such a bizarre film to rewatch when you look at David Fincher now in the 2010s lens, which rhymes and is fun. I think a lot of people, when they think of Fincher, they think of films like Social Network, Gone Girl, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, films that all have this very cold, calculated, you know, very, I mean, obviously the static shots are popular with Fincher in a number of his films, but there is a precision in those films that is very different when you look at films like Seven or The Game or films from his earlier work, and even in his music video work when he was doing stuff with Madonna, you know? When you're looking at the sort of dichotomy in his filmmaking, Fight Club is this sort of synthesis. What's interesting about it is that you have Tyler Durden and the narrator, and the narrator sort of represents this newer Fincher versus Durden, who sort of represents the older Fincher
Seven
style.
Fincher, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously Brad Pitt, which is a funny connection, but it sort of does feel like the film brings these stylistic elements into synthesis. And I was wondering, and I mean, this is something that when we were talking about it, you brought up that you sort of feel the same way in that the film sort of, it brings these two Fincher styles together. And I was wondering if you wanted to comment on that.
I love grimy Fincher. I think Seven and Blade Runner are two movies where Fincher didn't make Blade Runner, in case anyone thinks I think that. But Seven and Blade Runner are two movies where I feel like you can just reach out and touch like the rain and the grime and sort of it, they just feel like, I love the aesthetic of those movies. For as ugly as it is, I just love the aesthetic of those movies. And then a movie like The Social Network or Gone Girl, they are movies about sort of like rich, white, clean people, you know? So it's like, it makes sense to shoot them from, as you were saying, this very crisp, clean, kind of cold lens. But then I think Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is one of these movies where I'm like, oh, Fincher's doing another serial killer movie. And, you know, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross are doing the score. And like the first picture you saw of Rooney Mara was so badass and cool and like, ugh. And then what do you get? You get this very clean, crisp, almost sterile movie. And I love that movie. And I think it's really well done. But I miss Dirty Fincher. I miss the sort of Fincher that is making movies that feel like Seven. And I really think it's about the medium fitting the style fitting the medium and the story, I guess. So that's why I think like clean, crisp Fincher makes perfect sense for Social Network and Gone Girl. And grimy Fincher makes perfect sense for Seven. And in my mind, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but he went a different way with that. And as we were saying, Fight Club is this really cool marriage of those two things where you have the kind of clean cut shots, which are often around like the IKEA reveal of the narrator's room and that kind of thing. And then
which
you
is
have
wild,
just
by
the
way, by the way, even in 99, that effect still holds up really well.
Yeah, it's funny. The CG in this movie is like it holds up pretty well, I think largely because it's never meant for you to think that it's real. When I'm watching, you know, his face blow up, or I'm watching like the camera go around the stove burner or something like that, I don't think Fincher was ever, even in 99, was like, they're going to think we got a tiny camera and spun it around. It's like, no, you're showing me a very stylized shot to prove a point of what you're doing. And I think that works. So yeah, it's a really cool marriage of like the two Finchers, basically.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the CGI. I was curious about your take on it, because I am a firm believer that, you know, the sort of photorealism trend in visual effects is only good when it services the story, you know, and it's not something that breaks a movie for me. You know, I don't think a movie needs to look the most real or really feel realistic if the story doesn't need to function that way. Fight Club is a great example because, you know, those CG scenes feel very artificial. They feel very plastic. They feel very fake. I agree with you that I don't think Fincher was, I mean, I do think there was a part of it that was like, look at all this cool stuff we can do when we do CGI. But there is a part of it that, which is, you know, the more interesting part to me, which is this doesn't feel right. It feels like it almost feels too much. Like, I feel like I'm too into it. Like, I feel like, you know, when I'm literally inside the narrator and, you know, when we're literally going down the barrel of the gun, I feel almost kind of like displaced. There is something bizarre about watching those sequences, especially 10 years later. And I think, of course, the last one when, you know, the narrator shoots himself is probably the most indicative of this for me, because to me, that CGI represents sort of all the things about the narrator that we really don't like, the sort of the artificialness of his character. And by showing that in the scene where he shoots himself, it kind of feels like he's destroying that alongside Tyler Durden. He's really finding that balance that you mentioned before. And so when you're watching all these moments like the IKEA moment, and where, you know, the fridge, when we see how the apartment exploded is another great example. When you see the gas burner in the fridge, it does feel like these fake things that don't really exist, which is exactly what the narrator is projecting. A lot of what the narrator is projecting is not real. It's completely in his own brain. So, you know, I think a lot of people could watch Fight Club and say like, oh, well, that CGI looks so fake, you know, like, and it was obviously in 99. So like, you know, go figure. But like, I like that. I think that was a very pointed choice that Fincher made that I think makes the film, odd, ironically enough, stand the test of time.
Fincher does love to do Look What We Can Do. You know,
he's so it's showy.
Social Network, the characters are twins. Are we going to hire twins? No, we're going to hire two guys who are similar size. We're going to make one of Mac both parts. We're going to put his face on his face. Okay, they're standing outside now and they're cold, so they can just shiver, right? We'll get it. No, we're going to add CG smoke or breath coming out of their mouths, you know?
What's really fascinating about this film is that it obviously is, as you said, irreverent and grimy and just so many, oh my God, the abandoned house is so gross. I still get grossed out, you know, like when he like brushes his teeth with like the brown water and like, it does have this sliminess that Seven also has. The CGI moments, along with a lot of the cinematography, is very precise. There is a precision. The camera movements, the way in which the narrator and Tyler interact with each other. There are all of these very, very detailed moments that only somebody like Fincher could really have so much control over. Obviously, Fight Club, I do think, stands out in Fincher's filmography just because I do think he has made such a transition. But there is that precision. There are these camera movements and there are these tropes in there that, like, you know you're watching something Fincher-esque. Brian, this has been a great conversation. Love talking about Fight Club with you. We have one last segment on our show that we end off with, which is the MFMI lightning round. Lightning sound effects here. And this is the part of the show where we just go through some superlatives about the film, pick your brain a little bit about what your favorite parts of the film are and moments that stick out to you. And, you know, it's going to be tough. These are very tough questions, but give me as impulsive as an answer as you can. Favorite scene?
The bar scene is nice. It's a little bit of an obvious one where Tyler and the narrator are really sitting down for the first time. But it is a nice setup of these of the theme of the movie and these characters' relationships.
Now, why do guys like you and I know what a teffeh is? Is this essential to our survival in the hunter-gatherer sense of the word? No. What are we then?
Consumers.
Right. We are consumers. We are byproducts of a lifestyle obsession. Murder, crime, poverty, these things don't concern me. What concerns me are celebrity magazines, television with 500 channels, some guy's name on my underwear, Rogaine, Viagra, Olestra. The things you own end up owning you.
It also ends with these two ideals literally fighting each other. And I think it's a nice sort of setup for what the rest of the movie is going to be, is that these opposing characters are going to actually, they are going to be at odds.
My favorite scene probably has to be when Edward Norton beats himself up in his boss's office.
Oh, it's so good.
It's a brilliant scene, but it also is incredibly great foreshadowing for the for the twist.
Of course.
Favorite line?
Let me see if I can get this right. It's company policy never to imply ownership in the event of a dildo. It's always a dildo, never your dildo.
Yes, that is a great...
That's my favorite line.
To be honest, though, my favorite line from that scene is, it's usually like a electric razor 9 times out of 10, but sometimes... And you think he's going to say like a bomb or something? He's like, right. It's a dildo or it's a vibrator.
He looks around to make sure no one's listening.
It's a vibrator. Favorite shot or sequence of shots?
I think the IKEA reveal of Jack's apartment. It's sort of satirical, but it's also impressive and it's fun.
Favorite song or piece of score featured in the film?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. The opening theme is awesome. The homework assignment where they have to start a fight, that's another example of the music.
Yes, that's a great
so playful
piece of music there.
Yeah.
Hey, watch out, jackass. Come on.
Now, this is not as easy as it sounds.
Favorite set or location?
It's got to be the Paper Street house. It's so filthy. It's so great. It's so grimy,
and,
like you said, the brown water.
When they start working on it, it actually starts looking livable. I'm like, you know what?
Almost,
you know what? Yeah. With an Extreme Makeover Home Edition episode, this could happen. Favorite piece of trivia or behind-the-scenes know-how?
It's actually not trivia or anything, but there are these two PSAs that Edward Norton did one and Brad Pitt did one that I don't know if they ever like actually showed it before a theater, but it's them sort of starting out their PSA as like, the exits are located here and here and that, you know, please,
wow, they did,
you know, whatever.
They did like the movie
yeah.
instructions with the Fight Club characters. I have to find
But then
those.
They turn crazy by the end.
Favorite reaction when you've told somebody that this is one of your favorite movies?
The most common reaction is just like, oh, Brad Pitt is so ripped in that.
I mean, by the end of the movie, they just know. They just know.
Yeah.
And they're just selling the merchandise by the end.
Right.
By the time they buzz cut him, which is such an iconic Brad Pitt look, by the way, like with the buzz and like with the shirt, they know. If you had to pair Fight Club with another film to make a double feature, what would it be? And the only stipulation I'm putting is obviously no other Fincher films.
I think a double header that starts with American Beauty and ends with Fight Club would be great. Two 1999 films about a bored office worker who quits his job when he begins to wake up and really see the world, but he takes it too far and maybe goes from one end of the spectrum to the other and, you know, has to figure out what the balance is and may or may not be okay at the end, put it that way.
Yes, it's another great film in the discussion of the unlikable protagonist, American Beauty. The last question, Brian, in the battle of your two favorite movies, which movie loses to Fight Club?
I would say Labyrinth.
Labyrinth. Interesting.
I grew up watching it from the age of probably 12 or something like that, and I just love it. I love David Bowie. I love Jennifer Connelly. I love Jim Henson. It's written by Terry Jones of Monty Python. It's produced by George Lucas, you know, all this stuff. But also, it's another movie that has stuff to say. Like, you watch that movie once, you're like, that was fun. And you watch it a few times, you're like, ooh, there's like a kind of a dark and interesting thing going on here with what the protagonist is going through. And was any of this movie even real? And if not, what does that mean? And where is she at the end? All that kind of stuff.
It's interesting. Very similar to Fight Club. There's sort of the exterior factors that you love.
Exactly,
and then
yeah.
There's the core of it. Oh, man, this was so much fun. Brian, thank you for being here. It was such a pleasure to have you. Let the people know where they can find you, where they can see all your great work.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun, and always happy to talk about Fight Club and Fincher. I am on Twitter at Brian Bittner, BrianBittner. And you can find us on your podcast app at Beyond the Screenplay, and you can find us at YouTube. We have a Beyond the Screenplay YouTube also, and Lessons from the Screenplay and Story Mode. Basically, just follow us on Twitter, and then you'll see all of our stuff as it happens.
Brian, it was so great to have you on the show. I hope to, in the future, have your fellow BTS and LFTS team members on the show as well. But in the meantime, it was great having you here. Thanks for being here, and I hope you got as much out of this conversation as I got out of it.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks so much.
Guys, I gotta give a huge thank you to Brian for being on the show. Beyond the Screenplay is one of my favorite film podcasts. In fact, it is one of the inspirations for this very podcast. So to have him on was like kind of surreal. I'm trying to keep chill, but it's kind of surreal. So thank you so much to Brian for giving us his time and for being on the show. And of course, check out Lessons from the Screenplay and Beyond the Screenplay and Story Mode and all of the amazing work he's doing on all of those channels. You heard it from me. It's MFMI approved. And of course, we have to give a big thank you to you, the viewer, for listening to this episode. I really, really do appreciate it. And just a reminder, you can follow us on your podcasting app of choice for new episodes of My Favorite Movie Is, which go live every other Monday. And if you like video podcasts, like me, who doesn't love a good video podcast? We do have a YouTube channel where we post video versions of every episode the Friday after it drops. We don't have a channel link yet because we need to get 100 subscribers for us to do that. Please subscribe so we can do that. But, you know, just search for My Favorite Movie Is in the search bar, and hopefully you'll find us. And subscribe, hit the notification bell, support the show on YouTube, and get notified when new episodes go live. We are on social media at MFMI Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. We post some fun sneak peek clips. We also post reminders when new episodes go live, and we'll be posting some fun bonus content very soon. I promise we're working on some really great content right now, but in the meantime, you know, retweet, like, follow, do all those buzzwords on the social platforms to help spread the word about the show and give us some support. We really do appreciate it. Also, if you listen on iTunes, you should review us. I don't know why I haven't been pushing this harder, but apparently on iTunes, reviews are pretty important. So if you could take 5 minutes out of your day to just leave us a review, 5 stars, I hope, and some comments about what you like about it. It's a very small deed that has a huge impact on the show's success. So thank you in advance for that if you choose to support us. And as always, for more information about the show, as well as a full catalog of audio and video episodes, you can go to mfmipodcast.com. That's our website. We also have an email for any concerns or questions, hello@mfmipodcast.com. That's also there for your convenience. So many ways to get in touch, so many ways to support the show and tell us how much you love us. And I think that just about does it for this week's episode. Until next time, thanks for listening. My Favorite Movie is a Larry Fried Presents production. It is executive produced, created, hosted, and directed by me, Larry Fried, and is also produced by me alongside Brian Novak, who is also the assistant director of this episode. Our editors are myself, as well as Clayton and Kimberly Allen. Our graphic designer is Monica Sarmiento. Our motion graphics designer is Elton Greenfield. And our theme song, Now and Then, as well as all original music featured on this show, is performed and composed by Matt Gorduke. For this episode, our camera operator was Rob Bond. Our sound recordist was producer Brian Novak. And our production assistant
was Jason Lopez. Thank you all so much for your help in making this show possible. Everybody's links and websites and portfolios and what have you are all available down in the show notes below. My name is Larry Fried, and this has been My Favorite Movie Is.